This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. Ka-ching. Come on, guys, we talked about this. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. You want to grow big? Shopify. You want to grow small? Shopify. You want to grow medium rare? Also Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, number 714, brought to you by the Netflix Behind the Scenes podcast. New episodes of Behind the Scenes are out now with new episodes weekly and iFanboy listeners like you.
I'm so tired.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week. It's episode 714. I'm Josh Flanagan. I'm here with Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello.
So on a continuum of 1 to 10, last week we'll say we were at, I want to say 2. Maybe I was at 3, you were at 1, so we'll come out at 2. Where are we now?
Maybe.
Average your day. I know there's current, but
sure.
Sort of,
5 or 6.
5 or 6, not bad, not bad. I would say...
That's average.
I give myself a 6.
So we're still under the weather in various ways. Mine more overtly audio, and Josh is more covert and painful.
And, internally, as it were.
But we're here for you and each other.
Always.
Yeah, so we're hanging in there. So people mentioned, why didn't you get sub-hosts? This is life, man.
It's true. That's
I mean, if I had been worse, I would have had someone sub in, but what can you do? That's a lot of burden to place on the host, sub-host.
You can't do it at the last minute because there's a great deal of prep required for the show.
Right.
Hours and hours and hours of reading, and if you're not planning to come on, why would you do that to yourself?
Last week it was like I got real bad right before. Like last week, we were just going to talk about this for a while. Last week I... The day we recorded was the worst day I've had in 3 weeks. So it didn't, you know, I didn't realize how bad I was until I woke up that morning. At that point, it's too late to get a sub host. So
yeah.
Anyway, we're both sick, but we both read our comics and talked about them. And dude, you can keep reading the show.
Oh, right. We are doing that. Yeah. I fanboy. We have a stack of, each week we read a stack of comics. One of picks their favorite book. Last week I had to do it. This week Connor had to do it. We called that the pick of the week. I'm sorry. We talk about the other books and that one and the patron pick. Listener mail, if we have time. We're going to vary that a little this week, but it's still actually listener mail. It should be a good time. There will be spoilers. It's in the books. Exercise caution if you have not read them, but you should probably just read them. Connor, you had the pick. Go along.
I did. And last week we talked about how, you know, returning from the break and all these giant weeks of books that we missed while we were on break, and we come back and we had a really, really small week, and it was weird. And this week, it felt like the exact same week. It was really small. I think I had like 11 books, and I texted you because I had made fun of you last week. I texted you because I had read every book but one, and I was like, I'm sorry for making fun of you last week. I think every book I read at that point no, there was no book that would have given more than 3 stars out of 5 to.
Right.
And it was just kind of like a very, very middling week. And then the last book I had that I hadn't read yet was The Question, The Deaths of Vic Sage, Book 2, which is a Black Label miniseries from Jeff Lemire, Dennis Cowan, Bill Sienkiewicz, Chris Sotomayor, and Willie Schubert. I was about 4 pages into it, and I was like, oh, thank God. At least this book is being made at a really high level of craft. Mm-hmm. That's something to be, and it's this particular issue is a Western. And it became a very easy decision after that. The thing about this is I don't know what it is, this miniseries. So I'm just sort of taking it issue by issue. I'm by no means a Question expert, though I am a Question fan. Did you read this?
I did.
Okay,
I did.
So I was about a quarter of the way through it, and I was like, so are they setting up Victor Zsasz as a bad guy for the Question? And then I was like, wait a minute, this seems wrong. So I looked it up, and the Question's retconned real name is Charles Victor Zsasz, and then Batman's serial killer bad guy's name is Victor Zsasz, but their names are spelled just slightly differently.
The S and the Z are transposed?
Yes, yeah, so that seems so weird to me.
It's a weird choice.
It's a very weird choice. So about a quarter way through, I thought we were setting up a villain here, like turning Zsasz into a Question villain, and then it all got thrown out in my head.
Vic Sage. Yeah, I actually did have some confusion for a while, and I don't fully understand what happened with the naming and who's who, but by the end I knew who everybody was and what was going on.
Yep.
For the most part. So once I got over the name, because I thought, well, that's weird. This is an old-time Mr. Zsasz story in a Question book.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's a weird choice, and it's not a choice of clarity at all. But if you put that aside.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought it was a great issue. It was very – first of all, if you told me this was Jeff Lemire without me knowing.
I would never have known that, yeah.
It really a high level of I guess diversity of work here.
Yeah.
You know, like it didn't feel like him at all. And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah. And I said, I don't even remember what happened in the first issue. I took this as a single issue cowboy story.
Yeah.
And if you take it that way, it's terrific. And we're going to get to the art in a second, but man, Victor Zsasz is the blacksmith in town, and they're going to hang him a black man wrongly for a crime he didn't commit, and he puts his neck out in the line to save him and his wife, and they run out of town. They encounter an American Indian woman who saves them from the posse, and it all sort of goes sideways, and it was just a great Western story on its face without the elements in the background of the villain of no face, and then he gets his mask, and he keeps having visions of the future, which brought me back to, do you remember From Hell? Remember the first time you read From Hell? That year everyone read it when that book, the compilation came out. And mm-hmm. It was a scary book on its face, but the scene that unsettled me the most for reasons I don't understand is the scene where Jack the Ripper sees the future. And I don't know why that unsettled me so much, but those kind of scenes for some reason psychologically do me in. And so there's a part here where he sees the future and I was like, ooh, creepy. And like I said, I don't know what's going on here, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, not necessarily a good thing, but as a single issue, and these are Black Label books, so this is like a chunk, a meaty, meaty 50-page story. It was really entertaining and incredibly well drawn.
Boy, I didn't know that, and it did not feel like it.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Like 2.5 comics worth.
Yeah, I mean, through the whole thing, I was a little confused, but I was invested, and I was not annoyed at the confusion, I suppose. Because you know what I kept going back to is that I thought, well, it's the Question.
Right.
Like, I probably shouldn't understand it fully. And I don't know if that's just me fooling myself, but it doesn't matter. That's how I was able to get there. Also, and this should be noted, it's grim. It's not you get to the end of it like, oh, that feels good. It's not. Everything is bad in this. It's probably appropriate for this time of year and our level of joy.
Yeah. And I have to keep reminding myself that it is a Black Label book, which means it is out of continuity. Mm-hmm. It is sort of a self-contained story. So at first I was annoyed because, you know, I've been well on record saying I hate the idea that all these characters are legacy characters now. And here mm-hmm. you have the Question existing in the Old West as well as in the present day. But it's a Black Label book, so it doesn't really matter. It's on its own. It's telling its own story. It's not worried about any other continuity, and that's fine. But let's talk about Dennis Cowan and Bill Sienkiewicz and their longstanding partnership, where Dennis Cowan is the really talented penciler, and then Bill Sienkiewicz brings his own spin to the inks. Ugh. Full disclosure, I worked with Bill Sienkiewicz on two projects last year. Nothing to do with any of this stuff or DC Comics. There's a bit at the end where they show the pencils and they show the inks, and then you can see the fully colored page in the beginning. And it's just so interesting to see how their styles work together and enhance each other. And this is a beautiful book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say it took me a while to come around to Sienkiewicz. And by that, I mean, I've been down with Sienkiewicz for a good decade or more. But I, you know, when I was younger, I just didn't get it. But like now, I can see it from 1,000 miles away.
Yep.
And it always brings me immense joy.
Yeah.
And to watch, you know, it really is hard to say which of those two elements is sort of preeminent and making me like this. But I would say that it really is the combination. It's the melding of those two artists working together to prove something. And then, you know, and then on this one, Chris Sotomayor comes in and doesn't screw it up. I want to give him more credit than that. And it looks fine and it's good and everything. But really, you know,
The palette is good and it's appropriate. It's not.
Yes.
It really works with the art. And I mean, if Dennis Cowan's storytelling is terrific, I mean, it's a Western, so there's action, but there's also a lot of talking. But there's so many like dramatic close-ups on people in here that is really great. There's a page here that I really love, page 18 on your digital reader. It's just a conversation, but it's drawn in such a way that the angles change. It gets close. It's really well done conversation page, and that's what Dennis Cowan brings.
That page actually has a lot of look at that third panel. It's very Steve Dillon-y.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's vice versa. Like Steve Dillon kind of takes that stuff from him.
And then Sienkiewicz comes in and puts the texture and the atmosphere on it, and it's a combination that always works really well. They work together quite a bit. This is an instance where you can really see what an inker can bring to the proceedings in an age where the inker is fast becoming the dodo bird. How the art changes, but still stays Dennis Cowan's art, but is given a little bit more interesting life to it with Sienkiewicz's inks on it. This was the best looking book by far of the week.
I like that what it has is this sort of combination of like roots American comics and Westerns, and then like definitely a dash of sort of European comics. It feels modern still. It doesn't feel like it, you know, like a throwbacky kind of thing. It's a lot of sort of all the things you want to see. And, you know, reading this doesn't not remind me of the gorgeousness of the Jonah Hex series.
Yep.
You know, like every issue had some wonderful, you know, European artist or somebody who sort of took in that style. And this felt like that. It's almost like the spaghetti Western of comics in a way.
Right.
Just has that feel to it that makes you, it just screams of quality and sort of care and like patience. Like the pages have a lot of patience to them, which I think fits the question really well. Like you really are having to think about everything that happens.
And the fact of the matter is you could... Again, I don't remember what happened in the first issue. I remember flashes of imagery, but you can definitely read this issue on its own and get a very entertaining and satisfying Western story out of it, and have elements of the question in it. But really, it's just it's a story of revenge, and it's great. I was so happy for many reasons when I finished it, because it was an easy pick of the week choice, but also because it was a great book in a week there were no other great books that came out for me. I was like, oh, thank God, because otherwise it would have been a real weird show.
I don't think I had as bad of a week as you did. I had things I could talk about.
I don't think it was bad. I just think for me, most things I read was just like, okay, that was a comic, you know.
Well, I mean, for us, that is bad. Bad is the thing you can talk about. Is not
right.
You know what I mean? There's not anything to learn with mediocre. The conversation after it was fine is boring for you to listen to and for us to have. I see what you mean.
What did you end up thinking of Second Coming as the final issue came out this week, issue 6, Mark Russell?
I fell off. Of it, so I haven't been keeping up with it. So you're on your own.
I'm not quite sure what this book was about.
So this was the last one.
This was the last issue, yeah.
All right. I have them sort of stacked up. I just lost him in the churn, and I love Mark Russell. I do, but for some reason I wasn't really drawn to return to this one.
This one seems like it should have been the winner, because again, we talked about it. He comes from a theology background, and this is all about, you know, religion and Christianity. And as often is the case, I feel like maybe this needed to be 12 issues. You know, most of his work has been 12 issues. I just feel like there was, he was trying to say something here, and I don't know that he actually ever got the chance to say it. There was parallel stories going on. You know, you got the story of the main hero, was it Sunspot or something, and him dealing with Jesus in the modern day, plus the flashbacks to the events of the Bible and then God up in heaven. So there was a lot going on. I don't know that anything ever got enough page count to really say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was always interesting. There was a lot, and there's a lot here in this issue particularly where we flash back to Jesus gathering his disciples and then eventually ending up crucified. And through Mark Russell's lens, you know, it was funny and entertaining and ironic and sad. It was never bad. This comic was never bad, and there was always great scenes and great ideas in it. I just don't know that if I, finishing it, I understand what he was trying to say with it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, I mean, if this was a thing that had started as, you know, I guess it was a Vertigo story, but it didn't, or whatever, and then it became its own thing. But it really is, I mean, Jesus notwithstanding, an original property. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, at least at this point, you know, his strength lies in imbuing an existing property and the sort of irony that he can put into that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all that stuff mixes together. Like maybe that's what he's great at, and sort of the whole cloth development of a new thing. Maybe he doesn't have that quite yet.
Possibly, but I mean, the main superhero is basically Superman with Lois Lane.
Yeah, and the worst thing he ever wrote was the Superman Lex Luthor thing from some anthology a while ago.
And to me, the most interesting part was always the other stuff, the Jesus stuff, the looking back at the Bible through more realistic, you know, lens, and Satan ends up being a character here. It was all, like I said, it was all worth reading and all interesting, and the art was good from Richard Pace and with Leonard Kirk inks on it in the modern day. But I finished it. I thought, wow, I feel like I should know what he wanted to say here, and I don't know that I did,
mm-hmm.
Which is a bummer. But I still enjoyed reading it, and he's got another book coming out called Billionaire Island, which I'm with Steve Pugh from Flintstones drawing it, and I'm excited for that.
Cool.
Again, from Ahoy Comics. And if he has a home here at Ahoy Comics that lets him publish his challenging stuff and Ahoy Comics gets to stay in business, then that's fine.
It works for me.
Yeah. I just don't know what the point was.
I'm going to finish this.
You should. Like, I think you should definitely read it.
Yeah. I actually missed a couple of issues of Red Sonja, and like I made sure to go back and get them. I don't always do that, so I will read it. Like it's one of those things where he's always saying something worth listening to, mm-hmm. at the very least. So I know that you're coming at everything this week from sort of like it was fine. Where are you specifically on Legion of Superheroes?
Well, if you had 2.5 issues in your Ryan Sook pool, then you won.
Yeah, I read the second issue, and the whole time I was like, Mike, look at this man draw. You know.
No, I mean, again, this was fine. This was, you know. I feel like perhaps two things I thought about reading this issue. One, as much as I hate Damian Wayne, I feel like bringing him into the future was wasted here.
Okay.
Like nothing really happened other than he got sick and they immediately sent him home for a story they've been building up for a while, and he's on the cover as Damian comes to the future, and he gets there and the joke is, you know, like what the air is different, and so he gets sick immediately and they have to give him meds, and then he's basically sidelined till the end and they send him home having forgotten what happened. And then the other thing is, The real charm of this book has been the team, and then for me, getting into the mythology with this general and all the stuff, I get a little bit over my head.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, which it should be. Every time you see the Legion, it's 57 characters standing around or whatever. And you know, if anybody has been preparing to do this his whole life, it's Bendis.
Right.
But one thing I thought is that I actually, for whatever reason, I really like how Bendis writes Damian and John together. I think. Mm-hmm. I haven't read that Super Sons book, and I don't plan to, but this is like he gets Damian just right so that like it squares with who the character's supposed to be, and you don't quite hate him. Right. And also, and that's just through the perspective of having him be with John, somebody who he literally considers, you know, a peer, and so therefore he's not always being condescending to him, which I think is helpful, and not painting him like that.
I would like to point out though that with the benefit of hindsight, the Legion of Superheroes refers to him as Baby Hitler. So clearly they know
maybe
what's going on.
So in the same sense, the bit where you said it felt like it was wasted, I really feel like they put a big crumb on the table that is intriguing. And I really want Superboy to watch the orientation.
Well, they – and yes.
I want to watch the orientation. I need to know what's coming up. I like that he made a mistake. I like that he was, you know, feeling overconfident. And I can't remember what Mon-El's deal is, by the way. What's his deal?
He's a Daxamite. They're very similar to Kryptonians. They have similar powers. Right. I think the implication here was that he's a big like Superboy fan and fanboy and was let down a bit.
Yep, I think that works. You know, I am every time I see this book, I think I don't really want to read that book, and then I read it and I am engaged and I want to know what happens next. You know, in terms of it's hard to grab on, though, with all these different characters. Like, I'm like, OK, I know which one Saturn Girl is.
There needs to be a focus. Like, we're 3 issues in and it still feels like we were dropped into the middle of this giant party and we have no idea what's going on.
And it's not all bad in that way.
But not at all.
It is a lot, and it makes you – yeah, focus, I think, is the thing you're talking about. Exactly.
And as you said, hopefully the orientation video, which Superboy has been not watching as a running joke, which at the end here, it sounds like he's going to finally watch because it says next issue, The Secret Origin of the Legion of Superheroes.
I mean, as a people manager, you really want to get everybody on board. And that's a big – you can't have a superpowered loose cannon going around and not really know what the goal is.
Well, I think he finally sees now that he has to sort of take a step back here a second.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If I'm the writer of this and I'm thinking about, like, this is a kid who can skate. He can do everything.
Right.
And it wasn't like Clark Kent, who had the parents who, you know, were like slow, you know. Not that Clark isn't a good parent, but it wasn't the same as Mama Pa Kent who you know, would just say, like, let's take it a bit at a time. People aren't ready for it. You're not ready for it. You know, this kid's a little more impetuous. He's seen what his dad can do, so there's less mystery in it. And I like that. I think that's a nice generational split that they've built up. I read both issues of The Batman's Grave sort of right in a row.
So did I.
And I feel like I'm enjoying it, but I don't know why.
Yeah, and the thing is, if The Batman's Grave number 3, which is Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch, if that had come out this week, that might have been the pick of the week because I really enjoyed that issue. I enjoyed really salty Alfred. I felt like there was a lot of interesting things going on. I believe that was the issue where Batman did a lot of like real detective work, which he never does anymore. And this issue was basically like a really long fight scene, and it was totally fine. It just, you know, I can't pick 3 as the pick of the week, and I can't make 3 and 4 the pick of the week. Mm-hmm. 4 was fine. Again, it was fine. It was a Brian Hitch fight scene. It was very much like Batman as Midnighter, much more overtly brutal and breaking bones and things. But it still was basically one long fight scene, which was, again, fine.
And that is why I liked it. Only because I don't know that I hear people say this about Warren Ellis, but I mean, people talk about his work as, you know, he created Decompression, or at least co-created it.
Or popularized it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But that guy, you know, throughout many of his books has the best fight scenes that I tend to read in comics. Hmm. And I'm not really into fight scenes, but when I think back to, God, what was that one called? The one he did with Declan Shalvey, which sort of disappeared.
Oh, right. That wasn't Trees. That was a different one.
No, that was Jason Howard. Anyway, that scene, you know, Declan Shalvey did some amazing fight scenes in that. It's really great sequential art. And to be honest, I don't tend to think of Brian Hitch as a guy who does that, because I tend to think of him as a pulled back scale, like here's a huge, you know, cosmic space fight or something like that. And in this, it was just close in, you know, hand to hand.
Crunch, crunch, punch, slap, kick, crunch.
Yeah.
Like it was very visceral, even though that was very mostly silent. It was not even really sound effects, but it was.
And I like that in comics, and I like to see these guys do that. And it doesn't, if you look at it in terms of like it's not moving the story forward or whatever, but as sort of an exercise to just watch somebody do their thing, I find it really impressive and interesting. And you know, these are two guys who have nothing left to prove, in a way, other than now is to prove we still got it or whatever. And I don't know what this story is. I don't even remember, but just watch them sort of work out stuff on a page like this, I thought was pretty entertaining, and also went by quickly.
I don't know. You know, there was that dead body that he found, and I don't know how it all ties into this guy. But it's been interesting to watch. It's, you know, Hitch's art I really enjoy, despite the fact that Alfred's face is constantly changing. It's been this weird sort of buddy comedy between Bruce and Alfred that I've enjoyed.
Yep.
I don't know what it is or what. I mean, we're only 4 issues into 12, so.
Oh, is it 12?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Well, that lets them take their time on stuff like this.
And so far, it's coming out.
Yeah.
Nightwing 68, Dan Jurgens, Travis Moore, and Ronan Klecoup. I wanted to only mention because I believe it was in 67 that Rick Grayson sustained another head injury, and now he's got his memories back.
Who saw that coming?
Although the memories are back, although he's not, it's not like he has been snapped back into Dick Grayson. He's still Rick Grayson, but with all the memories of Dick Grayson. So now he's very confused as to who he is inside.
Join the club.
Yeah. So that's all I really wanted to mention was that now his memories are back.
Huh.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying it or are you just, I've been in here this long.
It's fine.
All right.
It's not great.
But what would it take for you to drop a Nightwing book then?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Would you say you're closer to it than not, or like they'd have to abuse you quite a bit more?
Well, you're the one who made that pick of the week, the issue where he
and
lost.
And I never read another issue after it.
He lost his memory. That's really funny.
I just enjoyed that. It was like, you want to keep going? No, I'm good. There was a book we read last week where you basically said the same thing. It was the Captain Marvel spinoff one with the girl.
Oh,
the
right.
Star.
Yeah. But then I, you know? By the end of it, I think I talked myself into reading more.
Doesn't mean that you will when it comes out, though.
That is true.
And all it takes is to skip one. And then you're off. It's how it works. At least if you're like us.
I think Nightwing has definitely not been a bad book, but it's definitely not been a good book either. It's just been a book that told occasionally solid but mostly forgettable stories about Rick Grayson with amnesia. Mm-hmm. With these other Nightwings who found his stash of costumes and have been fighting crime for him. It's just been It's been fine. We'll find out where it goes from here.
So I missed Undiscovered Country 2 over the break. I did not love the first one.
Yep.
Despite, you know, liking the names involved for sure. So this is the point where you tell me yes or no. Go ahead and check.
Well, I'm not sure. So I read 2 and 3 together again. So we're playing catch up right now. From all
sure.
I definitely read comics over the break, but I didn't read all of my comics. I definitely didn't read them all as it came out.
Lot of comics that came out.
Well, there was one week where I had like 45 books on my pull list. While we were gone. Thank God we didn't have a show that week. So I've been catching up, and I'm almost there. I think I've got like 20 books left that I need to read. I read 2 and 3 of Undiscovered Country together. Scott Snyder, Charles Soule, Giuseppe Camicoli, Danielle Ortolini, Matt Wilson on colors and Crank on letters. It's not what I wanted. We talked about this in the first issue. This is not the book I was hoping for when it was announced. It's still not. I was hoping for something more grounded in DMZ-like. This is much more science fiction-y. But there is something here, and I just can't put my finger on it, that has kept me reading it. There was a reveal in issue 2 about one of the characters that was interesting. We dove deep in issue 3 here with the American culture expert, who I think is from Canada. So we got his backstory. There is interesting things here happening. It's still not exactly what I was hoping for, but so far I'm still reading it, and I'm not entirely sure why.
You want it to be good.
I do want it to. It's not bad, but it's just not what I wanted. So it's tough. I have to get around that in my head that there's, you know. I'll say this, Josh. Your favorite concept in science fiction has come into play here in this story, which is time relativity.
Oh, I do like that.
And so the idea that time within the borders of the United States is not moving the same way as time outside of the United States.
Ooh.
Which is why everything's mutated inside the United States.
Interesting.
So that was introduced in this issue. There keeps being interesting concepts that I'm like, that's interesting. So I'm still on board, even though I'm not loving it.
That sounds like a Charles thing more than a Scott thing to me.
I mean, who knows? But that was the big reveal in this issue, is that they discovered that, or at least the one guy discovered that time is not moving the same as where they are as everywhere else. So, Giuseppe Camicoli is, you know, really strong, and it's a huge book for Image. It's like their biggest debut in years.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
Which is great for everyone involved and for Image. It's just not exactly what I want, but I'm still reading it.
I might. I've got them. I could get down with that. So 5 years, number 7 has come out. There's a lot I like about this. There's an awful lot I like about this. I cannot imagine recommending this to anyone.
No.
Other than somebody who has already read everything Terry Moore has done and also really likes him.
Well, I've only read half, I'd say.
No, you're familiar.
I'm very confused by most of it.
Okay.
And I'm only reading, that's not true. I'm reading it because I really enjoyed the Strangers Paradise 25 book.
Uh-huh.
And there's some interesting concepts here, but character-wise and things happen and people show up and I'm like, I don't know. And I would say 50% of why I'm reading it is because Terry Moore is the best cartoonist in comics.
Yeah, and for me that's that, but it's also like I like seeing what else he can do.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very interesting to see what it is he is interested in doing at this point. Because, I mean, let's be honest, he can't be selling a ton of these.
No.
And so this is just a, like, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to take my characters. I'm not sure what this is, but I am intrigued. I don't know why Kachu has decided to do, I mean, I know why she's going to Russia, but I don't know why she thought that's a good idea. I was surprised that she was doing it. And then she gets pushed out a window and falls 5 stories. And I thought, good God. And then, I guess this is a spoiler, but you'll have to deal with it.
It's on the cover.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Well, I don't tend to look at the cover, so I didn't notice it.
It's on the cover, so you can't.
Yeah, it's true. So David shows up. Now, David was one of the main three characters in Strangers in Paradise, and he died as one of the saddest things I've ever read in a comic book, much like the end of the last season of Halt and Catch Fire. Mm. And I literally, oh my God. So I'm glad I didn't notice the cover. I think he's, you know, a memory, a ghost. He's not real.
Yeah, he's like,
although a lot of shit's going on. Doesn't matter. I was, you know, but because they had also, I guess, aged him or at least modernized him. Like, this is what he would look like if he was still alive today.
Yeah.
And her reaction to it was real. And then also, like, it was over really fast. And I thought, you just, same thing with the Batman's Grave that we just talked about. They just took their time.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, I'm just going to tell this the way I want. And I love that. And it's not like, it's not annoying me. It's not boring me. It's only given me a little bit of time, but I'm okay. I'm satisfied with that.
So a couple of things. One, I know David. I don't know as well, so I was equally shocked, even though I haven't read as much of that, like I said. But what's interesting is that so she falls out the window, and he's basically there asking her to get up. And you're right, because at first I was like, well, clearly he's just a hallucination. But there's a whole page where he's there, and he is. Oh wait, hold on. Okay. So she's – never mind. I was all wrong. She's – I thought he was interacting with a third character, but that's just Kachu's own, like, sort of consciousness.
Yeah.
So she's just sort of hallucinating David then.
But still bringing him in, like, it filled out a whole thing for me. I was like, all right, these are all these people.
And also you'd have to I think at some point you'd have to acknowledge David in this way because he was the third pillar of – third – you know, it was Strangers was three characters, and he hasn't really been in this story at all because
he's
dead.
And I had forgotten that, like, he's the dad of one of the you know, that's
the kids. Yeah,
yeah. It was. So again, it's pretty great, but I'm not sure if it's pretty great to anybody but me.
No, I can't imagine. I mean, again, I'm on the very edge. If you haven't read it at all, I would. You're holding on by your fingernails, and if that.
Sure. And let's take a moment to talk about the Netflix Behind the Scene podcast. I think about this stuff all the time. It's sort of a little bit behind, you know, why we do this show, these kinds of things. You know, how do writers develop their plots? How, you know, what inspires a character's outfit or why they're doing something or what the shot is? How many people does it take to make a monster on screen? On Netflix's Behind the Scene podcast, you get an exclusive look at how its biggest series are made. Find out how a season of your favorite show comes together from script to screen, all those details that you think about or maybe that you didn't think about, and then we'll find super fascinating. Season 1 of the podcast brought you to Hawkins, Indiana. It's the Stranger Things area. This is when they looked into that one in the third season. Now season 2 of the podcast is going to travel to the continent. In the world of The Witcher, in a 3-part miniseries of the podcast, the new season of Behind the Scenes takes you into the original adaptation of Andrew Sapkowski's best-selling books into the world of the Netflix original series The Witcher. There's a question. How do you take 3,000 pages of original material and bring that whole world to life? You know, with the writers, the cast, the crew, how do they distill all that down and make something? The series explores the characters of Geralt of Rivia, Yennefer of Vengerberg, Cirilla the Lion Cub of Sintra in detail. You will learn all those details about the things. It features everyone from executive producers, the cast, Swordmasters. And if you are like Connor and I and you watched all the behind the scenes of the Lord of the Rings DVDs long ago, you'll be down for something like that. This is the deeper understanding of the world of The Witcher. If you were a fan of the books or the show or both, it's going to be all there. Host Brendan Jenkins of Mogul and There's Something About Dolomite takes you through the adaptation process from the writer's room all the way to the screen. There are new episodes of the behind the scenes out right now. New episodes come out weekly as well. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Overcast, my mine of choice, or wherever else that you listen to podcasts. So get over there and do that. You know, it's great that we get content like this now.
Yeah, and if you listen to a show like this, you're probably interested in behind the scenes stuff and how stuff is made.
Yeah,
and that's always fascinating. I when I went to the Game of Thrones set, the best people I met were the Swordmasters. Those guys are awesome. Oh. Yeah, they're cool. So check it out, Netflix Behind the Scenes podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. So let's jump right to the patron pick. Those are all the books we wanted to talk about previous to the ad. Like we said, there wasn't a lot to say this week. There weren't a lot of books. So the show's a little different this week. So we're going right to the patron pick, which is patreon.com/ifanboy. Everyone who's a patron of the show can vote to add a book to the rundown. And this week, it was a squeaker. It was a three-way race, like the old subway race at the Yankee games on the screen. The winner ended up being Hellboy Winter Special 2019, which featured three short stories by various creative teams. And I haven't read a Hellboy comic in years.
Yeah, I don't think I've been that long, but I definitely have dropped off.
You were iFanboy's resident Hellboy expert for years.
I was kind of forced to be, but yes, that became my job.
Well, you were a big fan.
True, I was. Part of that was A, it's great. It's real good. But at one point, a person involved with the production of that book sent me a lot of the books, and I felt a little like, well, I better carry through on this, because mm-hmm. that was very nice of them. And it was not difficult.
I've always liked the books. I just fell off of them at some point.
Yep. Yeah.
So this was interesting to read. The first story was written by Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy. The second story was written by Chris Roberson. Third story by Scott Alley. First story, Mark Laszlo on art. Second story, Leila Del Duca. And third, oh, it was Andrea Moody. I don't know what I read, Josh. I mean, I read three short stories, but they were only vaguely related to winter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was snow outside. I thought the first story was the most successful story. The second story I liked. The third story I didn't like at all.
I'm pretty close with you. I think I liked the first story an awful lot.
Yeah.
Written by Mignola. It had the classic Hellboy moment of the, well, forget this. You know, let's get punching. You know, he says the line, hold the phone, mister. We aren't here to, you know, then gets blown away. And he's, all right, pal, that's about enough of that. You know, like it's son of a, it's all the classic Hellboy lines that do not get tiring and nor do Dave Stewart colors ever, 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 ever.
Right.
I can look at a Dave Stewart colored Hellboy. I don't know if
I'm
there's
really
anybody
surprised he didn't do the whole issue, because he was sort of the Hellboy guy. But I love the way that Hellboy pops. You know,
yeah.
he's you know, we're in Budapest in 1989, and it's very gray. It's winter. Everyone's very gray, and their skin is sort of fallow. And Hellboy his red just pops, and I just love that.
And I just always like how he also just exists in the world, like it's not a big deal to anybody right. around him. Like right. They might notice him, like you'd notice a guy with a prosthetic limb, mm-hmm. but, you know, that's fine, you know, like, but he just gets to be there, and I always like that about it, it's just, he's accepted. I thought this was a good short story, and let's keep in mind, Mike Mignola wrote the best two-page short story in comics history, as far as I'm concerned, so this does not surprise me.
You know, this was a very successful, had an arc, it had an irony, it had a very heartwarming ending, like, strangely enough, I mean, how long was this? Like 10 pages? Not even 10 pages?
Yeah.
If this had been the whole comic, I would have been like, oh, that was good.
And yes.
The problem is that each successive short story sort of took away from – it was about 10 pages. Each successive short story took away from it because they weren't as strong. They just sort of ended, whereas this one felt like a complete short story.
Well, the second story did have a conclusion, and I think it just wasn't – I don't know who anyone was.
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to ask you, who are these people? Because
I don't know. I mean, they felt like familiar characters in the Hellboy BPRD world. Like, it all seemed familiar, but I wasn't sure the specifics of who they were.
1924, upstate New York. We're in an inn, the Braithwood Mountain Inn, that's been snowed in. Someone has been murdered, and then the murderer ends up running outside and getting killed by the mythical beast that they were all telling sort of like a ghost story about in the beginning. And I was going to ask you, look, I assume this main woman who's telling the story is someone from the Hellboy universe. I just don't know who she was.
I don't remember. I don't have a clue.
Miss Jewel, that's her name.
I don't remember. She's probably a character, but it's been so long now that it was fine. You know, like yeah. I got what they were going for. It was basically a whodunit, you know, in the room kind of thing. The last one is perplexing.
Yeah.
Because it has a lot of elements of things that I really want to like.
The Andrea Mutyar was terrific.
I read it 2 or 3 times trying to see what I missed or if I had made the mistake, and I had to be like, wait, so, okay, wait, she's saying this board balloon, and then you do the page turn. And then at the end, so the last, okay, so basically what you have is, 1412 is when this takes place.
Yep.
And you have an old preacherish kind of guy writing his notes. And then immediately a flashback. That's not super clear that that's what's happening. Right. And him and two other guys go in with an axe and a pitchfork, and they're sort of going off to avenge God for the evils. And there's a bit of a flashback to the Crusades. And then we come back to him sort of – he's writing his sort of like
– his memoir.
Confession memoir, yeah. Kind of like a bunch of things at once. And then we keep cutting back and forwards, and they come up to this cabin. They smash down the door. And there's a man who's saying, you know, I'm a sinner. Come get me. And there's a mother there nursing a baby. And she turns around and she points out that her son, who is a werewolf, is their enemy and not the man. And then they have a look of stunned silence on their face and then walk away with their heads down low. And then the guy burns everything he just wrote.
Yeah, I don't understand. I
think they killed the baby.
I guess.
It was not clear. And I always find this weird because this is – Scott Alley's like the longtime editor of Dark Horse Comics. I'm like, if I was an editor, I'd be like, you need something else here. It does not translate. It's so vague as to be annoying. And it's not like you and I are bad at reading comics.
Yeah. I
I mean, I make mistakes, but I literally reread this 2 or 3 times.
It was tough. It was weird. It was a weird one. That was not successful as a short story.
It was close. It was close because I do find it interesting.
Yeah, again, the art was terrific.
Yes, it was.
Hellboy Winter Special 2019 patron pick. Let's rate it. Ratings out of 5.
Overall, huh?
Overall. And that's the tough thing because.
3.
Yeah, I'm gonna go 2.75.
Okay.
Overall, as an average.
Mm-hmm. Fair.
So there you go. Hellboy.
I did not enjoy reading it.
No, and it was interesting. I'm glad I got to read a Hellboy book because I haven't read one in a while. And the first story was really great. But I finished it. And I was like, whoa, what was the point of that? Anyway, patreon.com/ifanboy. That's where you can go vote to add a book to the rundown. But if you give it the $5 or higher level, you get your own superpower. And sometimes you get more than one because last week we were both so sick that we fucked up the script and didn't change the names on the script for the patron power. So people last week were the people who were in the previous week. And so they all had 2 powers. So we apologize to them and to you.
We don't apologize to them. They're thrilled.
Maybe they don't want 2 powers. Maybe they feel like that's gluttony.
Pick and choose.
That's true. So we're back on track this week now that we have some semblance of coherence to our brain. And we're going to give patron power to Ryan Kendall. And, Ryan's power is, and I just don't want to give sick related powers because I feel like that's cheap right now. So I'm going to say this, that Ryan's power is that his living space is always dust free. So his house or apartment, wherever he lives, it never needs to be dusted. The dust just isn't there.
Is it unusual to be in a place that has no dust?
It's just very clean. It's very clean. And it just happens by him being around. And it's not like a halo power. It's just that wherever he lives, it's very, very clean.
just his primary domicile.
Mm-hmm.
What if he gets successful and has like a second home, like a lake house? Is that also?
Then that's also very clean.
Okay. He would have been good to have around and lived with during the first act of Inception.
There you go. Yeah.
There's a Dust Bowl situation going on. Or Kansas in the 30s.
Well, his house would have been clean, but the topsoil still would have been a problem.
Right, but, well, breathing was a problem, though. At least that's you true. Go inside, that's get away true. From it, come in through the door sills. That's come true. On. Ken Burns did a documentary.
I understand. I'm just saying in his house, it would have been fine. It wouldn't have mitigated the entire problem.
All right.
His domicile was not the land.
I see. No, I realize that he does not unfallow the fallow.
Right.
I get that. I would also like to play records at his house.
That's true.
Because dust is the enemy.
Doesn't need to worry about cleaning his needle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Nope.
He has a pristine stylus.
Unlike me with a wall-to-wall carpet. It's like a constant it's like a constant battle with a needle.
Buddy, I got little kids and dogs. JP is able to read and produce schematics for anything. This is multi.
Explain.
You know, have you ever had to put something together
mm-hmm.
and the directions are sort of in – have you ever had to wire something?
Wire? Yeah. I mean, I've wired speaker wires, things like that.
Speaker wires, yeah. All the things. He can just – like when I do something like that, so if I have to install a car stereo or I have to put something together, which comes up more often than you would think for me,
mm-hmm.
I have to really concentrate on the diagrams and I will still then screw it up. And so that's not a he just looks at it like you would read English words on a page. Got okay. that. I'm sure there are people like that. But then the other side of it is that he can produce a schematic for anything that has to happen. You need a diagram for where to go. He's going to just like somebody writes down directions on a map. He's going to produce them. You're going to be able to read that. It's going to be this perfect.
He has two powers.
Yeah. All schematic based.
He can understand schematics and he can produce schematics.
Yeah. But not just any schematics. Like
perfect.
Just
perfect.
Perfect schematics. Also, if I should just love the word schematics, big fan of that as a word and concept.
On the first try.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no. It's like you want that guy to like, I can't figure out how to do this. It's like, come here. And you go, oh, clear as day. Thank you very much.
Hmm. Well, Andrew Nikovich, we're gonna stay in a similar vein here to the first power. Andrew Nikovich can unscratch any Blu-ray, CD, or record.
So he's like one of those winder things.
He just touches it and the damage is gone.
Man, I could use him here to help me with my 1969 copy of Led Zeppelin 2, which would be very valuable if it didn't look like somebody ice skated on it.
Right. So, no more problem with your physical media for jumping or skipping or scratching or what have you. He can fix it all.
You know, as a man who owns still, many hundreds of DVDs.
Yeah.
That scratching's never really been a problem with those.
Hmm.
I remember sometimes you'd get one from Netflix that was sort of so scratched. Yeah, I was always able to take care of mine.
I have one very annoying one that is scratched in a very annoying way, and I wish Andrew could come by and fix it.
Can you be more specific about that, or is it like a porno?
No, it's a bootleg of the original Star Wars movies without any of the special editions, and one of them is scratched in one spot, and it always fucks up watching it.
Oh, wow. You were almost the victim of an international incident with that, were you?
I was. I was almost detained because of those DVDs.
That's funny.
But
I mean, it probably wasn't at the time.
No, I was sweating a lot.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right.
Ex-Cangelical, I'll just assume that he's a person named Bob, but instead it's ex-Cangelical, or her. Their car and shoes always stay clean.
Car and shoes are always clean. So, we're all in the same zone here this week.
Particularly helpful in a winter environment.
Sure. No salt residue?
Well, yeah, because then you're like, because you look and you go, car's covered in salt. If I wash it, there's going to be a storm in 2 days. Ugh, what do you do? Then there's the having to wear boots and stuff inside and out, and also take them off and on as you go in so you don't tromp stuff all over. He doesn't have that problem.
Right.
Those two items stay clean. So obviously that solves a rust issue as well and saves a lot of money on car washes and water waste, to be frank.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go. You give it the $5 higher level. You get your own superpower on the show. And that's how the people support the show the most directly. We thank those people. Our next stretch goal, of course, is the monthly non-comics media podcast, and also uploading all the missing full-length video shows and mini shows we did a few years ago, few being 12, to our YouTube channel and reembed them on the website. So if you want to hit those stretch goals, patreon.com/ifanboy is where you can do it. Also, ifanboy.threadless.com is where you can find our t-shirts and related merchandise. Also, ifanboy.com/support is where you can help us out directly via PayPal, ifanboy.com/Amazon. That's where you can find links to buy our Booksplode books and also a general Amazon link. These are all the ways people help us keep the show going, support iFanboy. We thank everyone that does so. The show would not exist without you. And let's move on to listener mail. A little bit different this week with our listener mail. While we were on vacation, we got a bunch of mail, and I think 90% of it was in the same subject. So we picked one email to represent all of you who wrote in. So Tom C. from Newcastle, UK says, "Now that the Watchmen TV show and Doomsday Clock have wrapped up, could we have your verdict on both? Did either feel like a satisfactory sequel to Alan Moore's seminal work?" And I would say Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' seminal work. Let's deal with Doomsday Clock first, because I feel like that's the shorter conversation.
Yes, and I don't know if it's unfortunately or fortunately, but I think that we were in a unique position that if we're talking about both of them sort of happening at the same time or concluding at the same time, by the way, it's interesting that it took less time to produce the Watchmen show than for all the issues of the comic to come out, but that's neither here nor there. I did feel that Doomsday Clock in the end, and I don't know that I would have felt this without the show, was diminished. Not because of the scheduling and what it was supposed to be or whatever. I'm willing to look at the work on its own face. But in terms of faithfully recreating the intent of the original story, by the time I got to the end of Doomsday Clock, I thought, well, the TV show kind of made this obsolete in a way.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting take. So I read Doomsday Clock over the break. These emails came in, and I was like, I don't even remember what happened in it. That's not necessarily a knock on the book. That's just my brain being different when we're not doing the show or reading the comics as opposed to doing the show. So I had to reread it last night in order to talk about it because I had literally no memory of what happened in the book. The thing that's tough about Doomsday Clock is that it got its feet taken out by DC. So it ended up essentially being an Elseworlds book. A lot of people wanted to know how it's going to affect DC going forward and what's going to come out of it. And the answer is nothing. It's not going to affect anything. Because when it started 14 years ago, Geoff Johns was the chief creative officer of DC Entertainment. And by the time it ended, he had been removed from that position. So he's no longer in charge. And so the initial intent of this book was to reset DC continuity and bring it more back in line with the pre-52 continuity. Deal with what was seeded in DC Rebirth with Wally coming back and saying that their history had been changed by Dr. Manhattan. That was all seeded when Geoff Johns was in charge. He lost the power struggle. And so this book became, through the course of it being published, an Elseworlds title. And so ultimately it doesn't really affect DC one way or another. Dan DiDio has given it lip service about how they'll take some elements from it, but they're not really going to take any elements from it. It's not really going to affect anything. They might as well put a Black Label logo on the front and sell it that way because that's basically what it is now. So ultimately, it was, for me, a really enjoyable, fun miniseries by two top-tier talents doing ultimately top-tier work. There was a bit of rockiness in the beginning, but at the end of the day, it's not going to do anything for DC like it was meant to originally. It was meant to, as this issue of 12 does, brings back the Justice Society, brings back the history, brings back the Legions, the future history of DC, brings DC back in line with what it was before. And, of course, that's all irrelevant because none of that's happening in the other books. The Legion came back and the Justice Society was shown in the Justice League book on a different Earth. But really what Geoff Johns was trying to do here is completely irrelevant now.
See, I know what you're saying, and I don't think that's invalid, but I can't say any of that really colors my perception of the whole thing. What I was thinking, and we'll be done with this in one sec, I think what I was thinking is that at the end of it, when I watched the TV show and I listened to Lindelof talk about the TV show, I feel like he was really, really doing his best to make something that was consistent with what came before. And I think that Gary Frank was doing that to a large extent, but there was a bit of imitation in it, in a way. But then at the very end, what you have here is something that went in a very different direction with these characters than what would have happened in Lindelof's show. And it became very Geoff Johns at the end, this sort of hope of Superman and how that changes everything. And it's great. That's what you want Geoff Johns for. But in terms of satisfaction, like, wow, you really got what this text was, I would lean much more towards the Watchmen show. And I think that's the difference for me.
It's interesting because there were things in here that I thought were much more in line with the Watchmen book than the TV show at the end.
Huh.
And we're segueing a little bit into the show. The last couple episodes of the show kind of bugged me in the way that the first couple didn't. Ultimately, none of it matters. It's all quote unquote. It's not fan fiction because it's all officially licensed and
highly paid fan fiction.
It is what it is. You can take it and leave it as you like. I enjoyed Doomsday Clock. I thought it was well done. I think if I read it all together, I would really like it. But for me, I can't overlook the fact that what it was trying to do, which is something I was on board with, was taken out by editorial. And so now what you have is a very well done, high-end Elseworlds book as opposed to a book that is resetting DC in a much healthier direction. And I, as someone who was worried about where DC's going, that pall hung over reading it for me.
So moving on,
yep.
When we're talking about the Watchmen TV show, I guess I will...
You were not excited for it.
Not at all.
I was the only person I knew excited for it. I hung out with Ron and a couple of our buddies when he was in town right before, like a week before it aired, and they were all making fun of it and how bad it looked, and the trailer looked stupid, and I was the only one who was like, I'm excited for it. It looks good. I mean, Lindelof is a really talented TV maker, and the production value looks like everyone was bashing it. It was a very fun, cool thing to bash on Watchmen before it came out.
See, I don't know about that. I it's one of those, you know, fool me 100 times, don't fool me again. I thought if I get my hopes up for this, A, I don't have my hopes, because I was always like, I'm fine. I have the book. Everything's cool. We have the book. And I didn't understand. And, you know, I'm still angry about the lost television show. So, you know, I have that in my heart. I hadn't watched the leftovers. And I watched, I want to say, the first one. And I didn't fall in love. I think it took me 2 or 3 episodes to figure out what I was watching.
Of Watchmen. Yeah.
It was Mickey, because I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to say the Latin. If I could, it would be awesome right there. But when it did click, like, it was like I pushed all my chips in. I'm 100% in. And since that moment, I have literally been walking around, and every time it pops into my head, I have this feeling of disbelief. Like, I can't believe they got away with that. I can't believe that that is a thing that happened that other people liked who aren't like scholars of the Watchmen text. And that for me, everything along the line was compelling and fascinating and didn't, to me, like spiritually, I think it was 100% in line with what came before. And Alan Moore will never like it or be happy about it. But Dave Gibbons is half of that team, and he seems to be cool with it, and I'm happy that they're giving him a check.
Alan Moore likes the check he gets. But to me, the most interesting thing is that it was popular.
I still don't understand that.
Like, widely popular, because I agree with you. After the first couple episodes, I was like, wow, I mean, what do people think of this who've never read Watchmen, let alone a comic at all?
Yeah.
But apparently it was widely popular because HBO was desperate to do more of them, which they wouldn't have done if it had been, no one would have been watching it. I mean, right off the bat, the production was stellar. The costuming, the way it looked, the way it was shot, the way they used the titles. It wasn't afraid to embrace the comic in a way that the movie was in terms of the way it looked. You know, they didn't modernize the costumes.
No, that's Veidt's costume.
Everyone looked kind of hokey in their costumes, but uh-huh. In a way that worked.
Just like the comic would have done.
Right. And it didn't try to make them badass or cool. Like, and in that way, they became badass and cool. And I love the way that Tim Blake Nelson's costume looked. You know, just the reflecting mask he wore. And Regina King's costume was cool. Like, but even then when we saw the classic costumes, they looked right out of the comics, but they looked right and perfect. And just so right off the bat, the level of production was incredible. And Lindelof using it as a platform to talk about race in America was really interesting and made the show compelling and vital and modern. You know, there was something that just didn't just bug me, and that's fine. I still think this is a great show. It's still one of the best shows of last year. But like, the closer it got to the books, to me, the more I started to get a little bugged, mm-hmm. Which, you know, is what it is.
I think that's fair. I don't know that I don't relate, because I really the closer we got to the book and also I, you know, honestly, it really helped me to listen to the HBO podcast that came out with it, and that's not always the case, but in this, it was kind of amazing how thoughtful and reverent that it was and to really get it right, and his sort of motivation for doing it and his motivation for not doing more also. I think the moment that it clicked for me, I think I could not even pin it down, when Jean Smart comes on and I realized who she was, that she was Lori Blake. I think, you know, like I maybe internally yelped, but I just went, oh, I 1000% understand what this is. And she was the first bit that I was like, she's amazing. Well, that is, I mean, that was just a stellar bit of casting and also just of acting. The way that she portrayed that, I was like, oh, that's 100% that character from before. You know, and I like that they didn't feel the need to bring in Dan Dreiberg. They didn't, you know, to do that. They just told a story based with the things that they had.
It seemed a little strange to not even show him, since we saw every other character who was still around.
Maybe
not even a glimpse of what, because I think that it was, he was in jail, I think they said, but like it seemed, that seemed like a weird oversight considering we saw everyone else, but that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think I look at it like they didn't know what to do with him, so they didn't shoehorn him in for no reason. They didn't put in, but it doesn't matter. I think the more I went on when we started to figure out what was happening with Veidt, Jeremy Irons' performance as that guy absolutely changed him in my mind. And if I read the comic book now, I'm going to hear his voice. The way that he said Veidt, like he bites the end of it off every time he says it. And I was just, I was all in. And then I think the bit where, like, I was in, I'm enjoying it. The bit where I sort of fell in love, I think, is the Tim Blake, the Nelson's character one, where you pull back and it was like a, I don't know, it was big F you really to the movie. It was like, you're not going to show the squid? Watch this.
Well, that was that was the best episode, the one we saw his origin, you know, him being in New Jersey when the squid happens. And he was a great character. I mean, one of the most interesting things about the show was that they basically reformed the Watchmen without officially reforming them. So you had a Rorschach character, and you had a comedian, psychotic character. Like, you had all the sort of character types who were not a team but were in the story. So it was very familiar, even if it was only subconscious in your mind that the Watchmen were on screen. So I'll tell you the things I didn't like, and they're very minor, just to get them out of the way. I hated the voice they used for Dr. Manhattan before he changed over to the husband. Like when that episode where he's in the bar and talking to her and we never see his face, I hated his voice. I thought it was a terrible choice. The casting for him was terrible. It really bugged me at the end when finally they killed Dr. Manhattan that in his last moments, when he is everywhere at once, he only thinks of Angela. He doesn't think about Lori at all. He doesn't think about Janie, his first wife. It's only about Angela. And I felt to me like they were pushing their story to the expense of the original story. That really sat wrong with me. She was his great love, fine, but in his last moment, that he's not thinking of his other two loves felt wrong, felt really wrong. And then there was something else I didn't like. Oh, I mean, there's the controversy about Hood of Justice and who he was really. It was fine for the story. I thought it worked really well for the TV show, but makes no sense whatsoever if you read the book. I mean, those are minor things.
Yeah. I liked it. I liked the imagination. You don't need it. It's not going to ruin the book before it, but just the fact that it existed and it was as thoughtful as it was really, really impressed me. I guess I was just more. And the idea that, like, you know, Lindelof's just like, unless I have a reason to do another one right now, I can't think I do. I'm going to tell my story. And also he told an interesting bit where it's funny because people referred to the ending as a cliffhanger.
I didn't think so at all.
I didn't either. No. But he said, well, one time he went to the movies and God, I'm trying to remember what the movie was. Oh, it was Inception.
Yeah.
And he goes in the bathroom and he hears two guys peeing and talking about what it was. And the one guy was like, that was like the greatest ending I've ever seen. And the other guy, that was the worst ending I've ever seen. And he goes, I realize that there's people who, you know, they want that closure and other people who like that kind of ending that's sort of vague, but also you can infer. And he's like, and I realized I'm the guy who likes that ending. And I am too. This is Josh talking, you know. And so when they got to the end of it, I had no idea that anybody thought of that as a cliffhanger. I thought, oh, what a great ending.
The culture has shifted now towards everything has to be wrapped up at the end, and everything has to be spelled out at the end. Otherwise, it's unsuccessful. And I agree with you. I mean, I even thought it wasn't even a question because he laid everything out beforehand to know exactly what you're seeing at the end. And even though they don't explicitly show it, it's not like it's in question of what you're looking at. It's been laid out through the whole series. So that was puzzling to me that people thought that was even
like, what happened? Well, it was very clear what happened. They've been talking about it the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm with you. I love that. I love that. I love that.
I mean, but also I could make a case for the show doesn't, you know, the show, the book, whatever, they, you know, they want to subvert your, she falls in the water. You know, like, it's all like the comedian at the beat, it's all a big joke. That's his whole thing. Could have gone either way. Like, there's a thing to be made for it. Probably you're right. That would, you know, but I like that. I like that there's a plausible explanation for all those things, and you write your own ending. You know, you take the things and you figure out how you think it goes, and you don't need that answer. That doesn't make it better.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was a terrific show. It was utterly compelling. Every Sunday in my house was like, it's time for Watchmen. Turn the lights off. Don't turn the phone. Yeah. Like, turn the phones off. Like, it was crazy, and the fact that it was something that people everywhere were watching was really intense. The cast was terrific. Regina King continues to do amazing work. Tim Blake Nelson is he's great in everything he does, but he was so good in this.
Yeah, he was.
As you said, Jeremy Irons was terrific.
Fight.
The continued resurgence of Don Johnson's career is great. It was utterly unexpected and surprising and terrific. I'm glad it was made.
Yep. I tell you what, it didn't ruin any of the comic books, but it ruined that movie. Not that.
No, and the thing is, when you read Doomsday Clock, and it, you know, it's very different in terms of the way to look at the characters, and that's fine too. They're all different interpretations. At the end of the day, it's all just different interpretations of the same characters. And Watchmen is Watchmen. Everything else is what they are, and you can take it or leave it as you want it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it definitely puts a bullet in the back of those movies.
Oh sure, and the back, you know, and so this year to get that and The Boys,
right?
You know, when I had really been like, I don't want any more of this. I don't want all of this comic book stuff to really be superseded by film and movie adaptations. But both of those things came out, and I was like, all right, you do it like that, I'm cool.
I mean, it's so trite to say, but I would love to see Lindelof just do the book, because it, with that art direction, you know, it shows that whatever his aesthetic is, the art direction can work. And I would just love to have seen that story told. I really would love to interview some people who've never read the book before and who watched the show and what they thought of it. Because without the foundation of it, I feel like you'd be totally lost with it. But I guess apparently you're not.
Yeah. Well, that's the skill, I guess.
All right, so there you go, Tom. See, contact@ifanboy.com. Tom and a bunch of other people wrote in with a very similar question. And now you can stop writing in and asking about Watchmen and Doomsday Clock. But you can write us contact@ifanboy.com, get your email on the show, and thanks for everyone who does.
Let's put a time bullet in this one.
Yeah.
I literally, while we were doing this, I got an email confirmation from my January Talksplode. So I'm going to do my best to get you that before the end of the month comes out. As always, I'm not going to tell you who that is. There's a Booksplode that we also have planned at some point in the near future. That book is Batman by Neil Adams, Book 3. Now, I don't know if you know about comics from the past, but you can pretty much just read them at any point. So we're going to be starting at Book 3. We're not going to read 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
Bunch of 70s Neil Adams Batman comics. I don't know what else you need to know about that, but that's where we're going to go from here. Connor, we have a patron hangout coming
up. Yeah, so if you're a patron, in addition to all your other the fun things you get to do, we have our monthly patron hangout for 1 hour a month, Josh and I, and so usually Ron, hang out and talk about nonsense for your enjoyment. And this month's patron hangout is January 26th. You can find information over our Patreon page. But we look forward to those, and that'll be fun. Hopefully we are always not as sick. Also, the Tripwire Awards are currently happening. They are UK-based awards that anyone can vote on the recipients. The voting is online. And I mentioned earlier in the show that I worked with Bill Sienkiewicz on a couple of projects, one of which was Bill Sienkiewicz Revolution Volume 1, the art book celebrating his career. The company I used to work for did that book, and I had some hand in it. And if you would consider voting for it for the Tripwire Awards, I'd be appreciative in the Best Collection category. You can find a link to the voting on the show notes for the show. And I realize the funnel of internet interaction is what it is, and only a few of you will actually get to that point. But we appreciate if everyone who listened to the show voted, it would win in a landslide. If even a quarter of you voted, it would probably win handily. Even if a fifth of you voted, it would probably still win easily. So.
And if you're listening to this, it's not like you probably don't really appreciate Bill Sienkiewicz. So,
right. So,
you know,
if you don't mind going to ifanboy.com, finding the post for the show, going to that post, finding the link, voting for Bill Sienkiewicz. You can also vote for all the awards. But in the Best Collection category, Bill Sienkiewicz Revolution Volume 1, I would appreciate it. We worked really hard on it, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
You can find that over at ifanboy.com. You will find the post for this show. You will find all the podcasts that we've ever done. You will find 70 plus podcast interviews. You'll find a bunch of books, bloods. You will find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out by liking facebook.com/iFanboy and following at iFanboy on Twitter. And you can follow at iFanboy Comics on Instagram for best of the week in panels on a week that something comes out that's worth posting. You can follow us individually at CS Kilpatrick on Instagram and Jay Flanagan on Instagram. And possibly, I don't have Twitter right now. So there's that.
I'm crashing as the show. Luckily, the show is ending because I'm starting to. Everything's wearing off. If you like the show, please leave a review or star rating wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your aggregator is. It helps people find podcasts, helps people find the show. And we thank everyone who does that, helps spread the word. Even better than that is word of mouth, telling your friends who ask about podcasts. There's still lots of people out there who read comics and don't listen to comics podcasts. And there's always an opportunity.
That's insane.
For more listeners for all kinds of shows, any show you listen to, it'd be great to. To spread the word about them and those shows and our show, we thank you for doing that. So we're a little bit better this week. Hopefully next week we're even better, feeling better and more in tune with the world. I'm gonna go lay down now. I'm Connor.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm Josh. I'm already laying down pretty much, so that's good.
I'm so tired.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over. In your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it, and sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.